Okay. Hello, everybody. How are you out there? This is the Other People Show. I'm Brad Listy in Los Angeles, California. It's nice to be with you. I have on the program today Pedro Mairal, author of a novel called The Woman from Uruguay, available in North America from Bloomsbury. It was translated by Jennifer Croft. Pedro Mairal is an Argentine author. He's from Buenos Aires originally, and his other books include One Night with Sabrina Love, The Year of the Desert, and The Missing Year of Juan Salvatierra. Had a great time talking with him. That conversation is coming up in just a bit. Today's episode is made possible by Northwestern University Press and their new release, The Monster I Am Today, Leontine Price and A Life in Verse by Kevin Simmons. Leontine Price remains one of the 20th century's most revered opera singers and, notably, the first African-American to achieve such international acclaim. In movements encompassing poetry and prose, writer and musician Kevin Simmons explores Price as an icon, as a diva, a woman, a patriot, and he also explores himself as a fan, a budding singer, and a gay man. The book's passages move polyphonically through the contested spaces of Black identity, Black sound, Black sensibility, and Black history. That's The Monster I Am Today, Leontine Price and A Life in Verse by Kevin Simmons. Listeners of this program receive a 20% discount on the book. Just use the promo code PPL20. This offer is available at nupress.northwestern.edu. Get yourself a copy of The Monster I Am Today by Kevin Simmons and get 20% off at nupress.northwestern.edu. Just use the promo code PPL20. One more time, The Monster I Am Today by Kevin Simmons, nupress.northwestern.edu, and use the promo code PPL20 and get 20% off of that and any other title. So Pedro Mairal is my guest. His new novel, The Woman from Uruguay, available now in translation from Bloomsbury, a lovely translation by Jennifer Croft, and I'm very pleased to share this conversation with you right now. Here he is, folks. This is Pedro Mairal, and his new novel, one more time, is called The Woman from Uruguay.
And some of my friends, writers, said that to me. You did this easily. And it's true because I wrote it in about 2 or 3 months. But that style, that kind of sympathy or empathy you're talking about, and the way the character speaks in a very intimate way, that took me about 10 years of doing that kind of writing in some columns, in blogs, for journalism, all over the place. I was trying to write like that for a long time. So that took for about 10 years, but I cannot say that I was trying to write that novel for about 10 years. But yes, I can say that it took me 10 years to develop that tone, in a way, the intimate tone of the book. And then when I sat down and wrote it, it was easy, but it was very nice to do. It flew. It flowed. I don't know what the verb is there.
That's right.
It flowed. It was very, very gratifying to write it. Even if there's some hard moments or some dark parts, but it was very nice to write that. I felt very good writing it.
Okay. Well, that comes across in the read. And it makes sense that it would have been that way. I want to hear you talk a little bit more about the voice of the narrator and the tone, as you said, that you were working towards for the better part of a decade in other literary forms. I think you were saying in journalism and things like that. I mean, obviously we're all writing in our own voice one way or the other, but when you talk about like the intimacy of the tone, like what does that mean? Or how did you have to struggle to get there, and what challenges did you have to overcome? Or is it even something that you can articulate? I know a lot of this stuff is intuitive and you just sort of get to a place where you can kind of feel like it's right. But I'm just curious to know what it was that you were struggling through over those 10 years to get to the point where you had the voice and the tone where you wanted it.
I think there are several things. First, a certain kind of anti-hero tone. The loser, in a way, the vulnerable part of the character, I mean. That's something I was trying to show, and that I realized that made and produced some empathy or some sympathy with readers. When you show the weak side of a character, then there was this kind of bringing a notch down the literary tone, trying to be more, trying to get nearer to the spoken word in a way, or I don't know if the word colloquial exists in English.
Yes, yeah, sure.
A more colloquial tone. That was something that I practiced in blogs. For about a decade, I found it very interesting when people in blogs wrote about their everyday life, and they did it in a very loose way, not trying to make literature. And that was a better writing. I try to do that without losing some sharpness in the selection of words, without losing some poetry. I wanted the tone to be like somebody speaking to you or confessing something to you. But at the same way, it's a writer who's doing this, so he can also be colloquial, but he can be very specific with the words he's using, and he is confessing this to his wife, in a way. The whole novel is a long confession to his wife about the stupid thing he did that day in Uruguay, so. I wanted to have that intimacy. I wanted to have the spoken quality, the confession, and the anti-hero thing, and the poetry thing when it was necessary for the moment of the narrative. That's kind of the different things that make up or compose the tone of the novel, I think.
No, that's a great. I mean, that's a better answer than I was expecting. You must have been asked that question before, but I that covers it. And I want to give listeners who have not had a chance to read yet just kind of a broad overview. This is a novel about a day in the life of a married guy who commits adultery, essentially. He goes to Montevideo for a day to collect some money and to meet a younger woman who he is interested in and who he has had like a bit of a fling with before. Is that a decent enough thumbnail?
And of course things go wrong.
Yes. And of course things go wrong. So that's the story that you're telling. It takes place all in one day. And I want to ask you a bit more about this anti-hero voice, because again, you know, when it's done well, and it's delivered in the way that you deliver it, it tricks you into thinking that it's simple. But, you know, creating a character like this who is doing something untoward, you know, generally speaking, I think it's widely agreed upon that committing adultery is not ideal behavior from a middle-aged man. But to make that character likable and sympathetic, you talked about showing the weaker side or the broken side of a character and how that can help readers to connect. And I get that. I think that's true. I think that sometimes writers resist doing that because they're scared that it will make the character unlikable. Mm-hmm. But, and this is where I think craft and skill come into play. I think if you make the character too weak or too broken or too uncool, mm-hmm. readers will recoil. It's a bit of a balancing act, is it not?
Yes, and it's a very thin line. And of course, you don't, you cannot direct the way people read it. So I know as a fact that some people don't find any empathy and just think that the character is stupid. And I agree with that. I mean, my character Lucas is going through some confusion. He's blaming his family. I mean, his wife and his son for all his frustration. When it's just that he's not working. He's not writing. He's not focused. So he's blaming his family for that, and that's really a side of him that it's not likable at all. And when I say that the character has some of me, I mean some of my things, I always have to make clear that I love my kids, for example. I love my daughter. So maybe I took some of my things, my kind of my shadow, and I exaggerated. I took it a bit far, a bit farther. It is a very delicate line, but I think that's what makes characters human. I like very much how Italians do that in cinema, for example. Characters are weak, but they are likable at the same time. If you go too far with a weakness, it's true, you can just leave a lot of readers behind. And I mean, I have to say that it is a guy, white male, heterosexual, being unfaithful. It's non-sympathetic at all. We are nowadays very sensible about that. About men and their desires. I think that it was a risk, but I really thought that it was, if I was truly sincere with a character, I mean, if I managed to go to that place that it's a bit wrong, but at the same time, it's believable and it's true, then the book would save itself in a way. That's what I thought. And I'm really sorry that some people start reading it and they say, I can't stand the character, this macho guy going to be unfaithful with a younger woman. That's a shame. I mean, it's a pity that I lose a reader there. But I only hope that they could just continue reading and see that, he's an asshole, and his whole life falls apart. But I think he gets his lesson. I mean,
I mean, it's not like a story of triumph, you know.
And no.
I think, too, a couple of things come to mind. First is that I think Lucas is self-aware enough to recognize at least some of his own failings. This is not a character who's a sociopath, at least not in my reading. You know, this is a guy who's wrestling with himself and who understands I think, quite well, that he's crossing lines and that he has a large portion of the responsibility for the situation that he's in his life. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and this has more to do with you and your creative decisions as a writer, and I think it's really the key to why the novel works so well, or why it works so well for me, is the decision to make it a confession and to have Lucas, the narrator, throughout the course of the novel, addressing his ex-wife, his eventual ex-wife, in the second person, you. He's writing to her, and he's trying to explain to her and come clean. And that, to me, was a brilliant creative move. I haven't seen that done. I'm sure I'm sure there's probably a precedent somewhere. But I couldn't think of anything in recent memory where you have somebody kind of confessing to someone off camera, for lack of a better way of putting it. And I think that humanizes it. And I think that also puts the book onto firmer moral ground or something. I don't know. You could likely speak to it better than I could, but I found that to be a really big part of why the book is so effective.
I like the what you say about off the record confession, because I wrote the book, and I'm not sure myself if it's a confession that it is really said aloud by the character, or he's thinking about confessing that. Is the whole book something that he's going to show Catalina or not? I mean, in what instance?
And we should just say, confession? I just want to interrupt just so people don't get lost. Catalina being his wife / eventual ex-wife.
Exactly. Who, I mean, is he really reading that aloud to her, or is it something that he's thinking? I think that at some moment when I was writing it, the character said, "Well, I'm writing this to you," that kind of thing, and I scratched that out because it made it too real in a way, too physical. I wanted this confession to be in some kind of limbo, kind of floating nowhere in a way, just in the book. So you cannot really tell if he said that to her or what. I think that he's wrong he's wrong, and you can tell he's wrong, and he's frustrated and he's angry. He's broken, emotionally broken in a way, and he's trying to get a grasp of life, of trying to feel alive again. And he thinks that by meeting this Uruguayan woman, he's going to be again in a way. Alive, and of course it's completely wrong, and things turn out in a different way, and that's where things get interested, I think, because always the distance between what the character imagines that is going to happen and what really happens is, this kind of Quixote thing, no? That the character thinks that he's going to fight giants and their windmills. That's always very interesting. The distance between imagination and reality is always wonderful. And I find it in some ways funny, in a tragical way.
Yeah.
The other day I saw a video of a friend of mine playing soccer, and somebody made a pass to him and he ran after the ball, and you could see, because I know him, you could see what he wanted to do, You could see perfect that. I mean, and what he managed to do was pathetical. He's in his 50s like me, and he's heavy. And the distance between what he desired and what finally happened was hilarious, because it's a mini tragedy that we all go through all the time. And I think that this novel is a bit about that. I mean, a guy thinks that he's going to do all these things in the other side in Uruguay for the day, and it all goes wrong.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I think, too, what comes to mind for me, or what word comes to mind, is salvation. You have a character who is going to Montevideo, as I mentioned earlier, to collect some money that has been owed to him for writing projects. And this money is, in his mind, his salvation, because it's going to buy him time. It's going to pacify his wife. It's going to give him time to write his next book. You know, it's all these things, all the meanings that we imbue money with. But I think at the bottom of it, it's about happiness and salvation. This money is going to make things right. Likewise, there is the promise of this young woman. You know, she is a form of salvation. She's going to make him feel alive in ways that he has not felt in a long time. Perhaps she and he could forge a relationship that becomes the ideal relationship that people tend to dream about, you know, the quote-unquote perfect relationship. Who knows what kinds of extended meanings he might extrapolate, you know, from this one little fling that they had at that writing festival. You know, there's all the different ways that fantasy plays on the human mind. But I think of salvation, and I think of, I guess, happiness along with it, and the ways in which human beings, myself most definitely included, how we delude ourselves into thinking that like external things are going to make us happy in some grand or permanent way. And it's always, in the end, a kind of farce.
It is. Yeah, it is. It works like a dream. It works like a dream in everybody's mind, that kind of ideal thing. And some guys just go on with it. I'm talking about guys, because I mean women also sometimes do that. But I see some people my age that they start again with a younger woman, and you can see that they send their pictures in the Caribbean in a beautiful blue beach, and you kind of look at it and said, he's starting all again. He has no idea that everything starts again, and he's going to crash another plane. You can see that. It's a stupid side that we have. I wish, really, Brad, that I want to write about, maybe it's not that interesting, but I want to write about how this goes on. I mean, in a character that goes on with the marriage after his 50s, and how that works, and how a character makes that work. I mean, when I wrote that book, there was no light. There was no light at the end of the tunnel, as they say, with the idea of marriage. It was complete. I don't know. There was no oxygen there. It's a bitter book from the perspective of marriage, I think. I wish I could write someday of something more positive about a couple and how they work together and manage to go to get along and raise kids, and maybe it's not that interesting, but I wish I could do that, because it's the story of a failure, I think. He doesn't get what he wants. He gets something else, as it usually happens. But he's quite broken at the end too. He's raising his kid, but he's divorced, and I don't want to spoil the book because it's not about that exactly. But I wish I could kind of write not the second part, but the other side of marriage in a way.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think that I found sympathetic in the book, and that I always turn to literature for, whether it's a story of adultery or marriage or relationships, or it's this, whatever it is, it could be a war story, it could be anything. But great literature says the unspoken, and says it well, and maybe better than we ourselves could say it. And I think especially, at least from my observation and my experience, is that there's so much mystery in an intimate relationship, and there's so much secrecy and private shame. I think maybe in a healthy relationship, there's a good amount of dialogue and openness. That seems to be logical. But it isn't often that people will confess their doubt or their insecurity, or will express that, like, hey, my marriage right now, I don't know, I feel like I'm failing at it or screwing it up or it's not going well. People don't say those sorts of things, even to their close friends usually, especially guys. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, there's this pressure to, from a performative standpoint, to act like everything's fine. Human beings have a lot of that. It's born of, like, a competitive impulse, I think, and also just, a desire to be seen in a certain way. I think, too, to narrow this down to a writerly perspective, I don't think there's a writer alive who is married with children who hasn't, and I think everybody does this, right? You entertain alternate destinies, alternate paths exactly. that you could have taken. Like, wow, if I didn't have kids right now, I could be in, on the other side of the world in a studio apartment, just like painting watercolors and writing poetry or whatever it is, and I could be completely, completely devoted to my art without any kind of encumbrance or responsibility. And it's very human, I think, to do that, but I don't think it gets talked about much because there's shame around it. And so a book like this ventilates that a little bit and shows us how someone does that. And I think there's value in that. I mean, I think that people who might bristle at these imperfections and just completely condemn a character like this, I don't know. I question that a little bit. It's like, really? Like, maybe they're a lot better human beings, But I feel like most people I know, if they might not do exactly what this guy does, but I think they share a lot of human qualities with him, one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do is to shake this character and make him realize that what he had and what he was losing. I wouldn't want to be in a studio painting watercolors. I really thank my kids for completely destroying my life, what my life was before. I mean, I like that destruction. I think that I would be neurotic guy with my records, and I would be like, if I didn't have kids, I would be very neurotic and unhappy. But this is, I'm talking about myself. I think that my kids completely put upside down my life, and that's good. I mean, in a creative way too, it's very good. They break everything you had before, and you have to start there building something else. And I think that my character Lucas doesn't realize that until the end. He blames the idea of having a kid for not being able to ride, etc. And And he realizes, I think at the end, maybe he realizes that that it's good to be a father and to take care of a kid and to be scared about it, because nobody tells you about that, about how afraid you are when you have kids, that something can happen to them. That's paralyzing. So I don't know. I wish that there's a glimpse of that in the book, of somebody realizing at the end what he's losing, in a way, the idea of raising kids and kind of having a family.
What I think too, or what I notice in myself, is like it's almost embarrassing how wildly I can swing in the privacy of my own mind. Mm-hmm. It's at the point now where I've witnessed it enough that I'm getting better at just being curious about it when it happens, instead of maybe becoming it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'll give you an example. It could be something like, I'm never going to get this book done because my life is too fucking crazy. I've got to yeah. go to soccer practice, and I've got to take the kid to school, mm-hmm. and I've got to go to, you know, all these different things. And then the next day being like so enormously grateful, you know, just being like content, like lying in bed with my kids, watching a movie or whatever it is, you know, you yeah. have these like, and I'll just be like, wait, yesterday I was catastrophizing and today I'm like the perfect picture of a content, you know, middle-aged father or whatever. And it's absurd. Yeah. It's absurd the way these things unfold. And I guess maybe the answer is to have some healthy mistrust of both, you know, like don't get too
exactly,
invested yeah. in either.
Yeah, it is a roller coaster. It is a roller coaster. I think we're with ups and downs. And what I tell myself sometimes is it's only one ride. It's only one ride. I mean, I don't want to get to the end of it and say, I didn't really enjoy it. Sometimes in the same day. For example, I wrote this morning. I had to deliver a column for the newspaper, and I felt great. And after lunch, I was really feeling horrible. I don't know why. I don't know. I think that there's something. There's even some chemicals behind there. I mean, some stuff with the brain. I don't know. But I suppose there are some things that I know for a fact, for example, that if I write, I feel good. When I'm not writing, I feel horrible. I feel that I don't deserve my own life. There's no way of putting some order into this chaos, complete chaos. And I write just one page or half a page and things fall into place and things are okay. But when I'm not writing, I get really kind of toxic for everyone, and there's a cloud over my, or hanging over my head. And I suppose there's something about also doing some exercise. I mean, going for a walk, that's something else that kind of brings light. I wish I could kind of have a drive over that and control that, but I can't. I mean, it's something we are in this roller coaster, like we are driven completely by it. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to control those ups and downs. I mean, just enjoy when you're in the upper side.
Well, okay, I relate completely. I was talking on the show with another writer not too long ago, and we were comparing what we call our systems. You know, the systems of happiness that we've created for ourselves, or that we figured out, you know, this is what we need to be functional, or at least close to at our best. And mm-hmm. it involves like meditating, doing some exercise, talking with friends or having meaningful conversation, writing, you know, all these different pieces that if we hit those, like I would argue, I would actually press back a little bit on what you just said, is that I think you do know how to control it. I think it's a little bit of exercise and making sure you're writing. And if you do those things, then you are in control of it. But I think what you're lamenting is the fact that you need those things in the first place. And I sometimes wonder, because like just this morning, I'll give you an example of my bullshit, is I'm like driving. I went to go get groceries early just so I could avoid crowds. My wife and kids happened to be gone. So I slept like an unusually nice, peaceful night. I had a peaceful morning, you know, like no, I had like all the pieces in place, but I did not exercise. I went to the grocery store to get some, you know, domestic stuff done. And as I was there, I got a group text from a bunch of like buddies of mine, male friends who I haven't seen in a long time, like old college friends. And there was talk of like a golf trip outing. I don't play golf, and like I don't have the money to be like going to play golf. I don't know. Golf is a plutocratic sport. Like, you know, like you've got to have a lot of time and money to be golfing regularly, in my view. Maybe I'm wrong, but I suddenly started to get really down on myself. I was like, oh, I'm just not the guy who can golf. And I was like, I had this like operatic, like, you know, self-denigrating mind experience as I'm grocery shopping. You know what I'm saying? And then like I came out of it and I was like, what the hell was that all about? And now I'm talking to you. But this stuff happens to me all the time. And I wonder, by comparison, if other people have a neurochemistry that leaves them not so susceptible to these ups and downs, or is this the norm?
Yeah.
That's my question.
Yeah, I think there's also some other tricks, and that you mentioned meditating. I think that this feeling of life being somewhere else, you know, that's something I have to fight sometimes with. You are there buying some groceries, and the friends are talking about going golfing, and life is somewhere else. It would be better if I go to that trip, etc. And that kind of getting or being far away from where you are standing, I think that what helps me to bring back myself into the moment is poetry sometimes. Thinking about just, I could write a poem about this. I mean, if Allen Ginsberg could write a poem about the supermarket and saying that he sees Walt Whitman in the vegetables around the supermarket, there must be a way of writing about this, buying groceries this morning. I try to do that. Like, how would it be? How would a poem about this stupid moment be like? Without saying the word stupid, but I mean this kind of insignificant moment. Sometimes I manage to do that, and I write something, or sometimes I just think about it. It is just a question, but it helped me bring myself back to the moment and get near of this, because life is really this. I mean, of course, the beautiful trip going golfing, it must be beautiful, but you don't golf. I mean, Donald Trump golfs.
that alone is reason not to golf, in my view.
Yeah. And I think there's something about money and the idea of money that is always putting us there. Like, I'm going, it's all this kind of false future. I'm going to earn some money, and then I'm going to waste it with this. I'm going to buy this. And it's always that carrot in front of the donkey, in a way. I hope my novel is about a guy who just realizes that he becomes a bit himself at the end, and he's closer to his own present and his everyday life, and not dreaming about some other life that will never happen, in a way.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, I mean, it's funny that you mentioned Ginsberg, because I went through like a pretty intense Ginsberg phase a few months ago. I talked to one of Allen's biographers, And, you know, I was just like really in that mode and really inspired by how like outrageously open he was, you know, with his life on the page and how committed he was to his project of self-documentation and this kind of warts and all approach to literature. You know, he would share everything, it seemed like, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, what you're describing both in the I forget the name of the poem. There's the poem where he's at the supermarket.
Yes, I don't remember what the poem's name is. Yeah, but he mentions Walt Whitman between the vegetables or something like that. Oh, in the supermarket. I saw Walt Whitman in the supermarket, he says.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you or I or anyone finds themselves in one of those kind of gloomy mind states, self-critical, life is elsewhere, I'm a failure, this isn't going the way I had planned, whatever it is, I think that what you're talking about when you talk about poetry, and I find this as well, you know, poetry's great this way, is that it's a mode of careful attention. It's similar to meditation, you know, and it's all the same stuff in a way. And I mentioned too this this notion of like getting curious about what's happening as opposed to being what's happening in my mind. You know, I think all of it is of a piece. And as long as I do that, then I'm able to get a little bit of separation and I can kind of snap out of that trance.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's just, I think I just got to get better at catching myself. It's all a matter of, it's like a matter of intervals. You know, I'm getting better at catching myself more quickly than I used to. And hopefully I keep improving.
it's a kind of a small step aside, not going golfing, but just a very small step aside, kind of observing oneself or spying oneself and saying, well, this is happening. This is happening now. And the trick sometimes is for me is to really translate reality, if we could say that word without a lot of how do you call these
scare quotes?
Yeah, without a lot of quotes. The idea of translating reality into words or the senses, the five senses, and just kind of making a list of what you're seeing, and you're waiting in line, for example, and you start watching people's shoes or how people are dressed, or what's happening there in that in that boring moment. Because we are always kind of trying to get rid of the boring moments. And here comes the idea of the phone all the time. The phone getting rid of the boring moments. And getting rid of experience in a way, because we're not kind of experiencing things. We just interpose our phone between the what's happening and ourselves. No? We film this, and we go to see our kids in a play, and we put the phone between the what's happening and ourselves. And I think that I'm a bit erratic about this because I'm not very sure how I do it, but I try to really do a translation of the texture of living into words. That, of course, sometimes comes out as a poem, but it can be some moment too. There's a moment in the novel when Lucas is waiting in line at the bank, for example, and he sees something in a TV. And that's something that those are kind of exercises I do sometimes, trying to translate meaningless moments of everyday life into words. Because I think that we have to ask words to help us see again and feel again. And smell again. I mean, it's all about the five senses. I think that words help us see better. If you try to translate exactly what you're seeing or what you're smelling or what you're feeling or the tastes of things or the sounds, then you hear better and you smell better and you see better. I'm rambling.
No, I mean, but it resonates what you're saying. And I think, too, thinking of that scene at the bank and the TV and these kind of small moments of life, or thinking about me like slow walking through the grocery store, you know, having this psychodrama play out. That's the stuff of life. This is happening to everybody. And I think that writing, you know, not only does it help us if we go to literature regularly and we're reading regularly and we're exercising our minds in this way, I do think it helps us name our experiences and our surroundings better. I do think it enriches life in that way and deepens our experience of it. But it also illuminates these moments and these feelings and thoughts that go unspoken or unilluminated. You know, everybody's been through that at the bank or at the grocery store. Something, you know, this weird juxtaposition of events where you're doing something as mundane as cashing a check or withdrawing some money. And yet, you know, you're worried about a sick parent and you're contemplating your own mortality, or you're waiting for some test results from a doctor. You know, who knows what it is, but those two things happen all the time. And do we talk about them all that much? Probably not. I think that's why we go to books. And that's kind of the, or at least part of the project of being a writer, is to bring those things out of the shadows and into the light. I think, too, about happiness. I think your book is concerned with it. I talked about this with salvation and happiness. And it's such a fundamental question. And it sounds sort of simple to say it, but it's not something that I think most of us spend enough time thinking about. Like, what makes a person happy? Is it money? Is it sex? Is it the perfect marriage? Is it the perfect house and the golf club membership or whatever it is? You know what I'm saying? Like, I think like it's a deep question when you start to root around in it. And I think it can be very easy to trick ourselves into thinking that other people have the happiness that we want because they might have, you know, experiences or material goods or life circumstances that we don't have. Maybe that's a particularly American mode, but I'm sure it exists all over the place.
If you live inside capitalism, it is that way. The idea that having stuff makes you happy, but I think that it has to do with what we talked about doing things that make you happy. I mean, I think happiness is something that you build inside yourself. It's not something that you have to go after. It is, and I don't like the word happiness. I like kind of well-being or just being around without suffering in a way. I don't like the word happiness because it sounds a bit like being high in a way. Yeah, of course you have some moments that you are in this kind of in this kind of high thing without drugs, but. But I like the idea of kind of being okay or just going along with it, and but realizing that it's very short. This is, as I said, only one trip of the roller coaster. Really, I don't have answers for that. But I think my character. Kind of sees that light of the summer, that last summer he has in his brain, and the scenes with that girl in the beach, and that was his the fire inside him that made him go forward, and he wants to repeat that, and he goes to Uruguay for the day, and he wants to contact with that again. That girl, and And that's not there. That's simply not there, and she's in another kind of mode or moment or whatever. He realizes that it was all a ghost. I mean, a ghost that he built up in his own brain. She was a ghost in a way, and also the city of Montevideo and the idea of Uruguay was also a ghost of an ideal city, just that he made up through some videos. And so that happiness that he had in his head is simply something that it's not there, and it was never there in the first place. So he bangs against the wall, he crashes against the wall, I really enjoyed that. I mean, I thought that the harder he hits the wall, the better, because I wanted him to really get shaken by the experience in a way.
Yeah, it's funny how we can idealize place. We can imagine that if we just get here, things will be better. You know, like, it's very tempting to think like, wow, if I were just living in Paris right now or something, like maybe everything would be great. And, or, you know, people in, who are struggling with addiction will often do this. Like, I just need to get out of the city and go live in the country where I can be away from these bad influences. And, you know, it never works like that, because wherever you go, you bring yourself with you, you know, and it's,
yeah, exactly.
I think that's a big illusion, that change of location is going to be, you know, conclusive in terms of making things better. And I don't know, I relate, but it's still, man, it's so hard to flip that switch and turn that off. It's very easy to just fall into daydreams about that sort of thing.
Yeah. And unhappiness goes through customs, you know, with you. They don't stop you and take that away. You take it everywhere. I'm living now in Uruguay. I wasn't running after the Uruguayan woman, or the woman from Uruguay. I'm living now. I've been living here for about 7 months, more or less. What you realize is that you just change problems when you do something like that. I mean, you change your problems, which is always good, but you're the same person that you were on the other side. And it's very good to realize that, because people think that, if I move, if I go to another city, or if I had this, it would be better. It's always yourself, as you said.
Yeah, no, it's like I struggle with that a little bit, because we're raising our kids in Los Angeles, and I've talked about this for years and years. It's like, should we stay here? But where would we go if we left? And we've never been able to be decisive about it. And I think it's what we're talking about, that a change of location is not going to be a panacea. It's not going to fix everything. At the same time, I do think there are certain environments that are more conducive to a peaceful and happy life than others. You know, and there are certain environments that fit a person better than others. Some people are great fit in an urban environment. Some people are more likely to flourish in a more bucolic setting or whatever. And I think there's something to that. It's a matter of finding the equilibrium. You know, you don't want to, or I don't want to make decisions around stuff like that based on false pretenses. I also don't want to be the fool who stays in a place that isn't in his best interest or in his family's best interest out of some strange paralysis or fear. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's like, it's trying to navigate the tension between those two things.
Exactly. Yes. It's always this impossible balance. It's, it's an impossible balance, and nobody has the answers to these things. I don't know. I just married a wise person. That's what I did.
Good for you.
I think it would if it was for me, I would always be exactly in the same spot, and going through the end of the world just there. But I married somebody who, she has good intuition about when to move and when to make the move, etc. I just agree.
You just go along for the ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think like when it comes to that sort of thing, like, you know, so much of it has just got to do with kind of making the best of whatever situation you find yourself in. You know, like you make the decision, you live with it, you make the best of it. And I think you have a much better chance of being happy. I think, too, what you said about, you know, how your kids kind of destroy your life or turn it upside down or however you want to put it. When it comes to happiness, I think that maybe the under or like an undersold aspect of this, at least in the States, is the notion that my happiness is directly related to your happiness and to the happiness mm-hmm. of others. And that if you want to be a happy person, be compassionate, be kind to others, work, make part of your life's work trying to serve other people and make them happy. Mm-hmm. And that gets lost in the shuffle too much. Because I think it really is true. I think it really does deliver the goods. And there's something counterintuitive about it, especially in like a capitalist mindset, that service or careful attention to the needs of others, maybe even at the expense of your own, could actually be the thing that brings you out of misery or at yeah. least like a, you know, kind of a mild ennui.
Yeah, the idea of just being nice, you know. One of the things that was happening in Buenos Aires to me is that I was myself stopping to being nice to people because everybody was completely angry about everything. And you could feel in just in every corner it was kind of a two cars defying each other, who crossed first, and there were little wars all over the place, you know. And I realized that I was starting to be very angry too, and the idea of being nice to other people, we, you know, in a way we moved not so much about because of Argentina and the situation in Argentina, but because of the big city. The big city was really starting to get into our nerves and on our nerves, and we were starting to be being people that we didn't like ourselves. I'm not quite grasping it, but I'm starting to realizing that now. But yeah, there's also a sense of community and about what you're saying, no, the idea of helping others. I don't know what it is going to be like to live here in another country, but certainly there was something about just being a bit calmer.
Is it though? Has Montevideo
yeah.
been calmer?
It is a smaller city to start with, and than Buenos Aires. And because there are less people, it is a bit more organized. And we'll see. Because it's not that we are going to live here forever. I mean, we're planning to stay for a couple of years, and if we like it, we'll stay. But we'll see.
Hmm. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk some more about the spoken word quality, the intimacy of the voice of the book. I didn't get to this earlier, and I just want to deal with it a little bit because I find as a reader that I tend to respond more to writing or feel a greater energy in writing that carries this quality. Mm-hmm. I do a podcast, so I obviously like conversational tone and the spoken, you know, the spoken language. There's a lot of, I don't know, there's a human quality that's hard to get right on the page. But when it happens, I feel like I'm more likely to be absorbed by what I'm reading. And I think that, you know, there is quote unquote literary writing, or a more formal voice that, if it's executed well, can bring me right in. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it'll leave me feeling alienated. It'll put me at a remove from the story, or I'm noticing too much the style, you know, and I don't feel like there's a person there. I think that's what I'm always going. I'm going to literature for that. I'm going to anything for that. I'm going to this podcast for that. I just want to connect with a person. I want to feel like there's a human being on the other end of the line. And I felt that with your book. And, you know, you said that you wrote quickly. Once you finally got down to the business of writing this book, I guess I want to talk to you a little bit about the craft of imbuing your prose with that spoken quality and that human energy that makes it really feel personal and human on the page.
Well, I have to get... almost full credit to the translator, to Jenny Croft, because she did an excellent work managing to deliver that tone, that spoken quality of the character. I would never know how to do that in English. She's a great translator. In Spanish, I try to do that by not letting literature stand in the way. That's, I think, what you were talking about when you said that sometimes you read and you don't feel that there's a human energy there. I think that this is something very definite about the style of each person, each person's style. And on one side, you want to write like the big writers you've read, the big literature. On the other side, there's the way you would explain something to a friend of yours. And what you end up writing is somewhere in the middle. Some people go more towards the literary aspect, and some people go more towards the spoken to a friend style. That's what defines the style of each person, in a way. I try to go near the spoken energy, the spoken word. I mean, words that are alive, in a way. I think that language has a very strange quality of maintaining itself alive all the time. That's why it evolves and it changes, because it needs to stay alive and to be funny again, and to seduce and to lie and to convince. So it's always kind of sharpening itself. That's what language is all the time doing. And when a metaphor gets old, it doesn't work anymore. It's not funny anymore. So somebody finds another way of saying things, and it that's why it evolves. And I think that if you can manage to put your writing near that energy, you manage to write something that has kind of a sparkle of life in it. Because language is alive.
And so when you talk about writing quickly, how much of the story did you have fleshed out in your mind? Or did you do an outline? I'm always curious when a book kind of flows, as you said, out of a person in relatively short order, how much plotting is there, or how much of it is just like a really like hot streak of writing where, you know, your intuition is serving you really well and the thing is just unfolding in your mind on a day-to-day basis?
I think I had the book in my mind when I realized that it was all happening in one day. That's what really made me daydream the whole plot quite quickly. I think I made a list of things that weren't going to happen, but and I had very clear in my mind that it started when he woke up beside his wife and kid, and it was going to end when he was back this day trip and completely changed or destroyed or whatever. So there was something about the day structure that really helped me. I knew that in that day, the whole life was permitted in a way. I mean, I could do flashbacks and flash forwards as long as I went back afterwards to the rhythm of the trip, the day trip. He takes his car, then he takes a boat, and then he takes a bus, and then he arrives. And between that, he can remember stuff and go in a kind of a big flashback, like a trumpet solo. But he has to go back to the main melody in a way. The main melody of the book is that day. So I think I had the intuition of the book in my head, but then I don't realize how it's going to work and or what exactly is the tone or the rhythm exactly until I start writing. Mm. But I knew it was kind of a slow pace because I had to find details about that day, because that was going to be the pace, the speed. It was going to be slow. I mean, the whole life was going to get in that day, but it was the story of a day, and it was going to be kind of a Groundhog Day thing. With a guy remembering and repeating the same day and trying to understand what happened to him that day. There was something about kind of magnifying some moments where he just went, when you just go through life in full speed, but you kind of stop and you try to think what happened there, what happened exactly there when there was this song sounding in the radio, playing in the radio, and I was speaking to someone. So it is the story of a day, but it's a story also of a guy remembering and repeating and trying to realize what happened that day.
Mm. Yeah, and I think a couple things come to mind. First of all is, you know, when we were talking about the voice of the book and how you lean more towards the spoken, you know, I've not only heard this in conversations that I've had with writers on this show, but I've experienced it in my own life, is like when you're not writing for the page, whether you're writing some sort of more informal blog post or you're writing, especially I think in an email to a friend or a letter to a friend, how you can find yourself being like, I wish I could just write like that all
yeah,
the time.
Exactly.
Friends will tell you like, wow, this is really great. You're the, you know, you should write like this. And I think it's trying to get yourself loose enough or to find a way to kind of approximate that in more literary efforts. And then the other thing that strikes me, and I've been saying this to myself a lot lately and to others, is that when it comes to plotting a novel, like having a, what I call it, the vessel, and it has to do with time, especially once you have a sense of the vessel, the container for the book. And in the case of your novel, yeah, it's like that one day. I think when you said that was sort of the linchpin of the creative process for you, it's like once you had that in your head, everything started to click into place because you knew what you were working towards. You had a sense of the entire shape of the thing. And it's worth remembering how critical it is to just have a sense of the time span of the story that you're trying to tell. Again, it sounds elemental, but it's one of those things that can be very easy to overlook when you're sort of struggling creatively to get your wrap your head around what you're doing.
Yeah, the vessel is very, very important. I didn't use that word. I think it's very accurate. It's very good. I call it sometimes a frame, but the word vessel is better, because if not, it's kind of standing in the desert. There's no limit. There's no, I mean, everything can go in the novel, but that means that also everything is kind of meaningless also, because anything can go in, anything can go out. So when you find a frame, you find a vessel, you're continuously kind of stepping there or touching that. It's like a touch ground or somewhere where when you can play from there, in a way. It's difficult to explain, because the idea of the novel is always kind of a trash can where everything can fall in. You could write a 1,000 novel page, a 1,000-page novel, but if it doesn't have a vessel, then it has no structure at all.
Well, I'm thinking of Ulysses, since it was Bloom's Day yesterday.
Yeah.
But
yeah, exactly. It's one day.
There it is.
It all happens in one day. I think that that's what gave Joyce the structure for that. I mean, the whole universe goes into that day, and he can make an experiment in each chapter, just goes all over the place. He goes into the past of Ireland and et cetera. He goes all over the place in the life of these characters. But it's the day, what the thing that keeps him in place, in a way, and keeps the novel in place. If it, he tries to reproduce one day in the life of Dublin. I think if he would have made that into a week, for example, or a month, it would all have fallen apart, I think.
Mm, well, I think, too, I think what we're talking about is limitations, having a sense of your own limitations and giving yourself some ground rules, essentially.
They make you free. That's the interesting thing. The limitations make you free.
Right.
On the contrary, what people tend to think on the opposite, that limitations oppress you and but we're talking about literature here, no? But in literature, in the process, in the creative process, limitations are quite, what's the word for that? Stimulating, in a way.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, like, for some reason, I was just thinking of horror movies. There is this prevailing wisdom in Hollywood about how, you know, horror movies that all take place in one location. It has to do with cost, too, you know. This is just one example. But, you know, it's like easy to make these movies because they're cheaply made. You have one setting or set, essentially. Everything's happening there. Like, what's that movie? Like The Cabin in the Woods, you know. That.
Yeah, exactly.
The title says it all, you know. Like, you're not going anywhere else, you know. You're going to be in that cabin in the woods. And once you know that, though, it's like, okay, well, here's where I am, and this is the boundaries that I've created for myself. And then you have, like you said, like this ironic, like liberating effect that happens, where you feel the sense of freedom within that, as opposed to sitting there staring at the blank page with absolutely no boundaries at all. And
exactly,
that's too much responsibility. You're like, what the hell? I mean, if everything can go in here, then you know, I'm never gonna finish anything. So it's a necessity. I want to ask you, before I let you go, more about your biography and how you got into this racket. Tell me a little bit about, like, where you grew up and how you grew up and, like, how you came to books and writing.
Well, I'm the third. I have two sisters, two elder sisters. My father was a lawyer, and my mother made how do you call social worker, a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
She worked with homeless people. So basically, my mother taught me to trust people, and my father taught me to not trust people. So I'm a big salad, as we all are. I grew up in Buenos Aires in Argentina. I went to an English school, so this funny accent I have belongs to that.
What, may I ask why? Why did you go to an English school?
Because my father also did, and he found that it was a good upbringing in a way, a good education, and it wasn't the same school as him, but because he went to a boarding school, and my mother didn't want me to go to a boarding school, I still thank her for that. I went to a school that it was English, but I went in the morning and I left in the afternoon. There, it was also the Spanish part in there too. It was a very good school, but I don't know if it was exactly for me, because it was very sporty. There was a lot of importance in sports, and I was a complete wimp. But there was something of a anti-hero in me that grew there. Thinking of a way of having a comeback or a revenge against bullies, and I think that there's a part of me, of my writing, that it's that a long revenge against bullies and kind of sporty track guys. And then I started, I thought I wanted to start to study medicine when I finished school, and I failed completely just in the first year. The sciences completely destroyed me, maths and biology and science. And but I didn't dare say back home that I couldn't confess that I was failing. So I went to the cafeteria every morning in the university. I thought it was less of a lie if I went to the university, but I just went to the cafeteria, and I started reading there a lot, and I started doing my own writing. And then I realized that I wanted to study literature. But I didn't know how to say that, because with the kind of big father figure of the lawyer. And so you remember that film where that was called The Dead Poets Society?
Sure, yeah.
There was a kid that committed suicide because they didn't let him study theater. So I told my parents, it is very important for me that you go and see this movie. And they went, and I remember them when they came back from the cinema, and they were pale and saying, of course you have to study whatever you want. So it was a horrible trick, but it worked. I started studying literature the next year, and I started going to a writer's workshop in a parallel way, because the literature studies make you turn you into a good reader, but not necessarily into a writer. So I went to a workshop by myself, and it was very good, because it was something parallel to the reading part. And I started writing poems and short stories, and then I send my first novel to how do you call these things when there's a lot of novels competing? How do you call that?
A contest, or
a contest, a literary contest, and my novel won. That was in 98. That's how I started writing in a way, I think I owe a lot to to the literature career, of course, the studies, but I think I owe even more to that workshop, where I even met my wife there. We were friends for a long time, and now we're still friends, but we're married too, and we're in love. But that workshop was very important for me. I learned a lot of things. I learned not only about the teacher there, but the group, listening to other people write and read what they wrote and discussing things. And I still have with me that kind of idea of the group thinking things. It's like I brought the group into me, and when there's some subject or something, I can sometimes imagine what we would have said in those times between everyone. So it was very, very important for me, that workshop, that writing workshop.
Okay, that's fascinating. Like, first of all, I think, you know, a workshop environment, a community of people who are also trying to write versus the, you know, the literary course of study that you're doing academically. It's like the difference between like reading a cookbook and actually cooking.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
or being like, crazy and studying psychology.
Yeah. So, but I think too, and this is where I often fail in writing more than I would like, is in this notion of writing as a communication. I think back to my own workshop experience, like especially maybe the very first workshop I ever did, where I submitted something that didn't land, and it was very instructive. Yeah. I was trying to be experimental on the page in the way of like a pretentious young guy, you know, thinking I was doing all this cool stuff, and people were like, what are you doing? It was like a distraction, and I wasn't communicating with anybody. And I think that great writers and works of literature that connect do so because they are very sensitive to the needs of the reader. They are operating in service of the reader as opposed to in service of the author's emotional need to express himself or herself. Yeah. That line is tricky for me. I think sometimes I fail to be of service to the reader enough. I guess everybody who's writing something that's not quite working is in that situation. But that's the way I sort of define it to myself. Like when a piece of writing connects and when a writer succeeds consistently, I think it's because they have an innate or intuitive sense of the person at the other end of the experience.
Yeah.
They're very finely attuned that way. And it might not be something that they have crystallized in their mind even. It could be intuition. Maybe what I'm talking about here is talent. Like people who are really talented have that sense, but I feel like, you know, getting to that place where you really have a sense of the reader experience along with the writer experience is, that's the battle.
Yeah, kind of being able to put yourself in the other end of the line in a way of what's going to happen with that text, what you're writing. You said the word communicating. I think it's all about that. I mean, you have to communicate, and of course what would probably happen with a very pretentious piece of writing when one is in his 20s and you go with a kind of pretentious thing to a group and nobody understands, and what you realize there is that you're not communicating basically, and that you have to communicate. And of course, that doesn't mean that you have to be basic and simple, and but that if you can do something complex, but always trying to be understood in the other end, that's just that happens in a lot of things in everyday life. I mean, doing this podcast, for example, we're communicating. there's a lot of places where I feel as I'm working as a person who communicates. I mean, I'm a writer, but I also write scripts sometimes or for TV or for cinema, and you're communicating there too. When I do some radio, you're communicating there, or some column for the newspaper. I use words to communicate. In Spanish, I'm a bit better than in English, that I feel kind of clumsy with English. But I think we are always communicating, and that and being able to communicate is, yeah, standing in the shoes of the person who is listening, without patronizing, because that's also kind of difficult sometimes when you start kind of patronizing or thinking that the other people is not going to understand. And so there's also, again, there a kind of balance of putting and standing in somewhere someone else's shoes, but also not underestimating the other person.
Mm. Oh? Well, and I think too, like on a related note, this workshop that you participated in as a student and which continues to serve you like all these years later, you were saying that you can imagine as you're working on a piece of writing how the group might respond. Like, mm-hmm. It sounds to me like maybe the most important thing that you derive from that experience is that it gave you a refined sense of how to communicate and how to write for an audience. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, that even if it's in your imagination, you have a very strong sense of how they might respond to your work, and it helps you self-edit. It helps you, again, refine your work and make sure that it's connecting. And maybe the lesson here is that, like, finding a good writing workshop or a good writing group, like a group of like-minded people to share your work with, is a worthy exercise at any stage.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting that you say the idea of audience, because I think that one of the things that I missed mentioning about the style that I attempted in the novel is this kind of little moments that sound a bit like stand-up comedy. Little moments when the character is kind of angry and speaking about, for example, doctors, or when he thinks about money, there is this little kind of almost like bits. And I feel that, yeah, I learned how to do that in that workshop, where it wasn't trying to get a laugh, but you try to get a smile from the other ones, from the readers, a little smile of, yeah, I can relate to that, and I understand that. It's not laughing out loud. If it is, it's welcome. But getting a kind of a smile from the readers, or the idea of audience, I like that.
I think, too, when you have a good editor or a good group of peers who are giving feedback, what they're often great at doing is very quickly pointing out whatever you're resisting. It's amazing to me how easily I can trick myself into being like, nah, I don't want to. You can kind of write around. You can write around pain. You can write around, difficult emotional terrain, like however it might materialize. But writers often do that. I often do that. And then you'll hand it over to somebody who's an astute reader and who might know you a little bit, and they'll immediately zero in.
Yeah,
exactly. On that place.
And you hate them.
Yeah.
No, I knew that. Why didn't I corrected myself? Yeah. It is very important to show the stuff you're working. Sometimes I have to show my stuff when it's finished, because I'm very vulnerable when I'm writing, still writing it. But I really need that feedback, the comments, and it's not always from people who are from the kind of literary group. It may be someone who is not a very frequent reader, just common sense. No, I really appreciate common sense. It is always gold to hear what some things somebody has to say about a manuscript or a book you're kind of finishing, or you've just finished, because you don't really know what you did. I don't know what I did, what I really managed to do, because I still have the ideas of what I wanted to do. So what the person sees when he's reading is what you managed to do. Yeah. And it's very important to listen what they have to say. And I think that writing workshops are a place where you learn how to listen. You learn how to listen. And once you learn how to listen and you kind of put down your own paper and your own anxiety of, oh, I just want to read my piece and just go home. And you start listening to others and thinking about your own writing through the other people's writing. And that's where the group starts working in a very kind of unique way. And the teacher is not that important. It's the group that starts kind of working in a real kind of place, but also, as I said, in your own brain afterwards, because it's a way of thinking.
I think too, you know, you said common sense. You know, you respond so well to common sense. Like, that sort of squares with my experience, you know, getting feedback in a workshop setting or from an agent or an editor, is that a good note on a manuscript is almost always self-evident. Like, as soon as you hear it, you go, oh, you know, it's very rarely. I mean, sometimes there's arguments. Like, sometimes you might have a little pushback or you might disagree with the note. But what I find more often than not is that when somebody spots an error, I'm just grateful. I'm like, thank God. You know, it's very obvious that they're right about it. And the evidence kind of feels like it's all there. You know, it's self-evident and common sense.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk to you. You know, we're sort of getting into process, because it sounds like you go through the writing and the drafting phase, and then you have people read. But just like on a day to day process level, like, are you a very ritualized writer? Are you working every day, or do you work in spurts? You know, where you're kind of 15, 16 hours a day, kind of getting a book done in 2 or 3 months. Like, how does it look for you?
With each book, it's completely different, really. I'm not a very focused person. I'm doing 100 things at the same time. Now that I'm 50, really, I have to work in the mornings. If I start writing in the night, then I generally cannot sleep afterwards. I try to sleep, and my brain is kind of caught into this kind of syntax or phrases, and I can't get some rest. So I have to, generally I write in the morning when I'm fresh. A thing I do sometimes is I disconnect the Wi-Fi, at least in my computer, and I put a paper beside the computer, where I call it the list of don't bother me now, because I'm writing and my brain says, you should connect now to just look for that specific word or that place in the map or whatever. And this constant kind of urge of distraction and of going through social media and so I write down in that paper, look for this or send this email to such and such. So it's afterwards, after 2 hours, and I connect again. Maybe of a list of 10 things, I only look for 2 or 3. The rest were just my own mob. You know, the mob of my brain trying to distract me. So that's something I do sometimes, but I don't sit down really and work for a lot of hours until I really have kind of the feeling of the book, and the almost the energy of the story drives me or drags me behind. I'm not a kind of a will person that I'm going to write a novel without wanting to write it for half a year or for a whole year. I really have to like the story, and there has to be a drive, and it's a bit of an external drive in a way, because it pulls me to do it. So I really don't have many rituals. That's the truth. I have to kind of make the time for each book and put aside things. And when I finally want to write that book, I kind of I put aside mountains. I don't know how I do that, but I do it.
How else do you get a book done? You kind of have to. You know, once again.
Yeah, exactly.
You have no choice.
You have to put yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you because, I think it's a saner way to do it, getting to the place where the book sort of drives you, you know, and it's kind of coalesced in your mind, at least to the point where, you know, you have a strong feel for the broad outline of the thing, and maybe have a sense of why you're writing it, you know, what the major themes are, something like that. But I want to know a little bit more about how you arrive at that place. You know, there must be mental work that you're doing in your downtime or when you're doing other things where you're sort of playing with ideas or building the story in your mind. You know what I'm saying? Like, what is that part of the creative process look like for you?
Well, I think that I have to be available. I have to be available for the ideas in a way. There's kind of an openness, and I'm dotting down some ideas. I have my scrapbooks and my copybooks, and I put down some ideas. But this kind of I don't know if the word exists in English. Roaming. What do cows do when they chew? What's the verb for that?
Oh, I mean chew. They chew their cud, as far as I know.
Yeah. Yeah, this kind of chewing and re-chewing, chewing an idea, you know. So I try to be available, and when I say that I'm available for ideas, is that I do this thing that I said a while ago of kind of stepping aside and looking at myself and saying, This might be good to write. No? For example, I find that there's two emotions that are really great creators of stories. For example, that is desire and being afraid. Both, I mean, when you're catched up in desire and you're imagining if I send a message and I go, and you know, all this great film that is happening in your brain, and if you step aside of yourself and you say, I've been daydreaming this whole story for about 10 minutes, there might be something there. And the same thing with fear. Fear is always kind of producing stories in your head too. Sometimes you're also daydreaming this whole situation of panic and what would happen if, and that's also where the kind of the step aside comes, and just observing that I've been producing this story in my head for the last 10 minutes. So sometimes I just put down in a few words those ideas. And of course, when characters have clear their desire or their fear, they become very clear characters in a way. They're kind of easily understood. So I have my notes, but I don't really go back to them very much. It's just a way of putting something into words and not losing it. But there's some kind of mechanics that in my brain that once I wrote it down, it kind of stays with me. I don't trust memory. I don't trust memory. That idea of that I'm going to remember this, that doesn't work. Sometimes I put down also in words things I hear or some phrasing. Somebody says something in a quite kind of very good way or interesting way of phrasing something in the street. I put that down. And that's about it. I mean, I don't know if the word being available sounds logical, but it's a way of being aware or being there for the ideas.
And then at some point, these ideas, you reach a kind of critical mass. Like they've had enough time to incubate. They've also there's also enough of them. You know, you have a bunch of them, and you're starting to see connections, and that's the creative momentum that you're talking about that eventually pushes you to the mm-hmm. keyboard.
Exactly. You have to sit down at some moment, and just be there and just write, because you can't stand it anymore. Because I mean, taking notes forever, it's horrible. Because you feel that it's something kind of building up and building up and building up, but you're not really building. And then comes this horrible moment when things get so different from what you imagined. You had a beautiful dream that you were dancing, and then you have to dance for real. I think writing is a bit standing that feeling, going through that feeling and realizing that it's going to be something different, but it is going to exist. Because if you don't put it down in words, it won't exist forever. And we are all geniuses inside our heads, but you have to try to do that outside your head. It can be really frustrating, but at the same time, that's the adventure of writing. That something happens that you didn't imagine, or you it wasn't planned in that way. And you get surprised of your own of how the story goes by its own, because it starts getting kind of being alive. If you try to control it all and try to make it exactly as you imagined it, then you kind of choke it. You have to leave it. You start writing it. You have something planned, but language by itself starts kind of writing its own rules. And the story starts going to a place where you didn't exactly imagine, but that is what makes the story alive, because it starts kind of breathing its own movement. It's kind of a slow animal that starts kind of moving forward. So it's all about control and not controlling. Again, this idea of balance, just let the story be and see where it takes you. And you cannot have everything controlled from beforehand. It's impossible.
Andy, you know, I think what you're talking about too is having the good sense to know when, you know, the story kind of, like you say, starts breathing on its own or moving on its own, and you might be landing on ideas that exceed your imagination. You know, it's like knowing when to recognize a good idea as it comes along, you know, and not resisting it simply because it diverges from your original conception.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's the good part of writing. And that's the interesting part about the fact that it will diverge. And that's the adventure of writing. If not, we wouldn't really do it. If it's something that exactly what you imagined, I mean, what's the difference of imagining it? So that's the nice part or the interesting part of writing, that part that you don't really control.
So what are you working on these days? Are you working on a book, a TV project, or what?
I'm writing on a I'm working on a kind of short stories of love dash sex and stories of couples and just people just being horrible. And those are the columns that I'm writing for the newspaper, but it's going to become a book. And I'm starting to work in something that I find it very challenging, that is writing lyrics for musicians that send me melodies and the kind of la-la-la thing, you know, a melody kind of sung without real words. And I put words to those. That's really interesting. It's something completely new for me. And it's wonderful because when you listen to the result of the musician singing your lyrics, it's beautiful.
Who are the musicians? Can we listen to anything you've done?
No. This is only starting now. And I hope the things get recorded. I realize that in the music world, it's a bit like in cinema, where there's a lot of scripts going around and only a few get filmed. And in music, this happens too. There's a lot of songs going around, and the ones that finally get recorded are just a few. But I have a kind of a duet with a friend of mine who is a musician, and the song is called La Tormentosa. That is in Spotify. That's the only one that is in Spotify. And also a rap for kids. That it's called El Rap de los Gatos. It's kind of the cat, the rap of the cats, or something like that. It's a song for kids. I'm writing songs for kids too, and that's really, really, that's the big challenge.
I was going to say, that's a different mode than the woman from Uruguay, right?
Yeah, exactly. It is completely, completely different. Yeah. They're the most difficult audience in the world, the kids.
Yeah, they'll tell you when it's working.
Yeah, they'll tell you exactly what they think. Yeah.
Well, Pedro, I have so enjoyed talking with you. I loved your novel. And kudos again to, I think it's Jennifer Croft, correct? The translator?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're in good hands with her. She did a wonderful job on the translation. And I have to imagine this is going to, you know, this book is going to win you some fans up here in the States and in North America. So kudos to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Brad. Thank you very much. And a big hello for everyone who's listening.
All right, there you have it. That is Pedro Mairal. And his new novel, The Woman from Uruguay, is available in translation from Bloomsbury. It was translated by Jennifer Croft. You can find Pedro online at pedromairal.com. He's on Twitter. His handle over there is at Mairal Pedro, and he's also on Instagram. Track him down. Once again, the novel is called The Woman from Uruguay, available from Bloomsbury. Go get your copy right now. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Every single episode, the entire archive of this show, is made available to you for free. It's a listener-supported show. If you like this program, if you listen regularly and you get something from it, and you have the means, I hope you'll consider supporting the show. You can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. For as little as $1 a month, you can support this show. Tip your server. There are different tiers, different levels of support. As you go up the scale, you can get stuff. You can get a tote bag, coffee mug, t-shirt, sticker. I will write you a postcard. I will wish you a happy birthday with a voice message. It's very user-friendly. Patreon.com/otherpplpod. The Other People podcast also has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. It, too, is free. Go get the app wherever apps are available. If you would like to write to me, the email address for the show is letters@otherpplpod.com. This podcast is also now available on YouTube. It's got a YouTube channel. The Other People with Brad Listy podcast is on YouTube. Check it out. Every single episode is there. Subscribe. to the YouTube channel. If you have a second and you want to help the cause, you can review the show. Rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts or wherever the podcast lives, Stitcher, you name it. Reviews help. It helps other people find the show algorithmically. So I'd appreciate that. Otherwise,